Welcome, everybody. It's time to begin. This is session 211, which is our Mother's Keeper. We've got three panelists today. I'll introduce them in a moment. Their names are Mark Brown, Melanie Franti, and Brad Kramer. Glad that they're all here, and we're glad that you are here as well. Just a quick reminder, please keep noise-making devices silenced. This session will go until 10:45, so it's an hour-long session. Let's do a little introduction. We're going to start out with Brad Kramer. Brad is a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at the University of Michigan, where he studies religious language, ritual, and Mormonism. He also holds degrees in American history and has worked extensively on Mormonism. In addition to blogging at ourmotherskeeper.com, he's also a regular contributor to By Common Consent. He currently lives in Ann Arbor with his spouse, Tracy, and five children. After we hear from Brad, we'll hear from Mark Brown, who grew up in Utah, and has many happy memories of camping and hiking in the mountains and the desert of the Beehive State. He pursues Mormon studies and avocation and is old enough to remember all the way back to when there was no winter inversion on the Wasatch Front.
Wow.
Nice.
Ancient days.
Indeed. Last but not least, we'll hear from Melanie Franti, who has a BS in geography and is completing another degree in environmental studies from the University of Utah. She's been hooked on ecological issues since she took her first earth science class in 2003. When she's not doing schoolwork, she digs in the dirt and rides bicycles in Salt Lake. So we'll go ahead and turn the time over to Brad. Thanks again for coming.
Okay. So, As we talked about the panel today, one of the things I think we were in agreement on was that ideally the most productive part of the discussion will in fact be the discussion. So if nothing else, my presentation is designed to give a very brief sort of elementary primer on ecofeminism, on the intersection of environmental and nature-related issues, and feminism, and to try to refract that a little bit through a Mormon lens and pose the question of whether or not Mormonism has something useful or distinctive to say about these particular issues. And I'm also really lousy at doing PowerPoint, preparing PowerPoint, so my slides don't do anything special. They don't even, like, there's no animation on them. I mean, it's just going to be one slide at a time with text. So, but it may still, you know, be a little bit. So ecofeminism is a way of both pointing out and challenging a certain aspect of the wider culture, and in particular, predominant sort of patriarchal culture. And here I mean patriarchal in the most sort of blandly descriptive sense, not in the specifically religious sense that Mormonism attaches to it, but simply cultures that have historically, traditionally been male-centric, and in which males have unequally advantageous access to power. So one of the things that ecofeminism tries to both point out but also to challenge is a certain way of thinking about the world, the social world, and the natural world that equates women with nature. And it's a little bit ironic because we trope on this a little bit in the blog, in the sort of conception of the blog and the description of the blog as our Mother's Keeper. I remember when we were talking, Mel and I were talking about blog names, and we came up with this idea, and we sort of wanted to test the water, and so she asked some of her friends, when I say Our Mother's Keeper, what do you think of? And they would say, it makes me think of environmentalism and maybe something having to do with women or even Heavenly Mother. Okay. So one of the ways, and again, these are just, this is a very brief introduction, but one of the ways that we think about, one of the ways that this sort of equivalence manifests itself in our culture is with the idea that women are more inherently intuitive and emotional, right, as opposed to being rational and reason-based creatures. So they're closer to their sort of natural instincts rather than sort of rising above their nature. Again, and that has to do as much with the way we talk about how, you know, the hormonal nature of women or something like that. Women are sort of prisoners of their own natural inclinations, and men a little less so. Obviously, these things are in flux in the culture of 2011. But historically, these things have unquestionably been the case, and they are still sort of ossified into certain aspects of our thinking. So if nature, I had the little standardized test analogy formula at the top, if nature stands in opposition to culture, in other words, if nature and culture are fundamentally different things, if culture imposes itself, imposes order onto nature, and if human nature is, or personhood is typically defined in largely male terms. In other words, if the way that we idealize human nature, human being, human capacity is in terms of masculine ideals. So again, follow the logic here. Nature and culture are separate. Personhood is idealized in largely masculine and male terms. And therefore, female becomes something that exists on the continuum between nature and culture. I'm sorry, between male and nature. Right? Male is on this end. It represents, in idealized terms, it represents sort of the epitome of rising above nature. And women aren't quite there. So if in patriarchal culture, again, which I'm just describing in normative terms here, women are perceived and construed as intrinsically connected with nature, then dominion or domination over nature and dominion or domination over women are also going to be connected with each other. We see this in traditional religious stories that sort of deal with, you know, the Eden story is incredibly rich. In terms of what it implies about not only the relationship that man has to nature, right? Man meaning the human race, but also the relationship that man has to woman. Remember, man has been given dominion over nature, which again, the specific content of what that means is something that's been debated in theological and religious circles for millennia. But nevertheless, man is given dominion over nature. And then as a consequence of the woman's irrational choice, right? And then the man's rational choice to follow her out of paradise. One of the consequences is that she will now be subordinate to him, as in this first underlying sort of highlighted phrase, "Thy desire shall be to thy husband, he shall rule over thee." And alienation from nature. So nature becomes something that is now sort of natural nature, right? The natural world becomes something that is that man competes with, that works against man and works against man's needs, right? So now the ground is cursed. You're going to have to work hard. You're going to have to extract from it from the sweat of your brow. So this raises an interesting question, I think a particularly interesting one, that's particularly interesting in sort of the Mormon paradigm, which is the subordination of women to men, the historical and cultural subordination of women, and the opposition between man and nature, is this a divinely ordained state of affairs, or is it a consequence of the fall? And is that even a meaningful distinction in the Mormon universe? Are the consequences of the fall a part of a larger divinely ordained plan? But is the subordinate position of women, the subservient position of women, is that an eternal thing? Is that a temporal thing that's not ideal? Right? Is it a manifestation of human corruption rather than a reflection of the way things are supposed to be in the eternities? So how are the exploitation of nature and the subordinate status of women related to each other? I argue that they're related both ideologically in that they play upon and reinforce each other. I'll go into this in a little bit more detail. And they also both strongly depend on the notion that nature and culture are fundamentally opposed to each other and sort of work against each other. And then practically, they also are related to each other in that it's one of the consequences of this is the devaluing of what is traditionally considered women's work, things that women do, including things that are quite important, you know, like nourishing children and, you know, stuff like that. And then also the effects of the kinds of cultural regulations associated with this worldview and the actual practical effects of exploiting nature are disproportionately borne by women, and that's particularly true for women outside of the First World. So these are just some possible examples how women and nature are both construed in very male-centric ways. So you have tropes of male aggression and female submission. That can be simple sort of social dispositions, or it can involve sexuality as well. Patriarchal culture is grounded in the logic of dominion and domination. In other words, when you conceive of these binaries, right, nature and culture, male and female, you always conceive of one as being as dominating over the other.
What is a trope?
I'm sorry?
I don't know the word trope.
A trope is is like a cliche that hasn't quite attained cliche status yet. But it's a sort of common way of thinking, a common way of framing something that you can play upon in order to generate shared meanings that hasn't quite become so overused that it sinks into the realm of cliche. But it probably wouldn't be entirely inaccurate to say cliches of male aggression and female submission. But these are culture saturated with it. The relationship between fertility and passivity in both descriptions of human sexuality, but also descriptions of the natural world, that somebody aggressively sows seed, proactively sows seed, and then there's a passive receptacle that just sort of inherently, instinctively nourishes it. Intuition, emotion, and body for women versus rationality, reason, and mind for men. So women are conceived by men primarily as bodies whose behavior is governed by intuition and emotion, whereas males are idealized as minds within bodies governed by rationality and reason. Even things like down at the bottom, what might be considered a more ideologically opposite side of the spectrum. You have this idea about the relationship between what women do and what happens to the natural world, in the notion that one of the ways that you can protect the natural world is by controlling something that is traditionally the purview of women, which is birth rates and reproduction. I want to wrap up here because I want to give time to the other panelists and I want there to be time for questions. But one of the things I want to talk about is this idea that what women do, the productive work that women engage in, is not visible to markets and therefore is not valued in the same way that men's work is. So if you take, for example, if you think of homemaking, right, the things traditionally associated with homemaking, gardening, making clothes, and then there's also, you know, chores and cleaning and stuff like that. The things that are obviously productive, right? Making something, making clothes, making, growing food, and these are the things that don't register in GDP calculations, right? It's not productive to grow food and then eat it. It's invisible to market calculations, right? If you're doing something productive, if you wanted to do something productive, you take the tomatoes from your garden, you take them to the farmer's market and sell them, and then go buy more of them with that money at Walmart. That's how you contribute to economies. You don't contribute to economy by growing food and eating it. And you don't contribute to an economy by making your own clothes, especially if you make it, you know, from scratch. I want to talk a little bit about the bottom here as well, just the fact that environmental exploitation globally has costs, and those costs aren't borne equally by all members of the human race. They're borne disproportionately by marginalized groups of all kinds. The health and other risk factors that are associated with intense environmental exploitation are globally disproportionately borne by women as opposed to men. And those women in the world who attempt to and are managing to provide for their families, they depend on local productive processes, being able to grow their own food, being able to gather their own water. And those their ability to do that is increasingly threatened and marginalized by large-scale sort of first-world development projects and by the ubiquity of the markets. So, steps toward a solution. I argue that it begins with how we think, that more than anything else, we don't just solve this problem by talking about the specific ways that domination manifests itself, but actually rethinking our reality. So the binary cultural logic, as I said before, is almost always hierarchical. So you have oppositional values, but one is always subordinate, superordinate to the other. So in the nature culture, culture is clearly superior to nature, right? Culture dominates nature, it controls, it orders nature. Male, female, the same thing. But when it comes to, so thinking about culture and nature, it turns out one of the very helpful things and one of the things that we're increasingly becoming aware of is that we are a part of nature. We're all embedded in complex ecosystems. We all participate in these ecosystems. We all partake of the consequences. And while culture might be distinctively human, or at least human culture is distinctively human, human experience is not comprised of a civilizing culture imposed upon our animal nature, but rather culture is our nature. We are naturally cultural beings, and we have been since longer than we've been Homo sapiens. Culture, human, what you described in the broadest, most generic possible terms, culture has been influencing our emergence as a species and our evolutionary progress for millions of years. So culture is an inherent part of who we are. Being human means being cultural. It is our nature. So trying to sort of shift away from thinking of nature and culture in those highly oppositional, highly distinctive terms is helpful. The other thing is this male-female binary. And I think it's tremendously helpful for men to figure out, and women, honestly, for some women, to figure out a way of thinking about women as primarily human and not just deficient men or non-men. Full human beings. That there isn't a sort of different species out there, that males and females, that men aren't from Mars and women aren't from Venus. We are all in God's image, male and female. We have heavenly parents. And again, we're turning to the specifically Mormon worldview here. The social and historical forms and patterns of inequality are not a reflection of an eternal, unchanging cosmic order, but rather a consequence of the fall. And therefore, these patterns of inequality and of subordination and of subservience and of domination are things to be overcome through repentance, through the power of atonement, of that one-ment. It is extremely difficult to sustain a concept of a fundamental sort of cosmological difference between men and women when you set aside a belief in a similarly cast distinction between culture and nature. Without that binary to sort of build on, the idea that fundamental difference is there becomes less meaningful and becomes less bound to forms and patterns of domination. commandment to multiply, right, to the sexual union and reproduction of men and women, is also connected with the man to the command to replenish as opposed to deplete the earth. And we should remember that achieving our potential, full exaltation, involves connections with each other in celestial and eternal marriage, in the male and female image of God, and with a celestialized earth. So these things are all connected to each other. And so if I guess the sort of the overarching lesson is how we think about the relationship between human beings and nature is connected with how we think about the relationship between men and women, and to how we enact those relationships. And changing the way that we think is key to fixing what we do in our daily lives. So, thank you.
First, I'd like to say thanks to you who are here to hear this panel. You honor us by your presence, and we're happy you're here. I'd like to this will be going over some of the same ground that Brad did, in a different way. One of the things that I really one of the best features of the blog that I really enjoy is just this practical nature of it. Like, we'll have a post about how to grow better tomatoes. And that's something that... is there anything more Mormon than that? I don't know. How to get good compost. This practical side of things has a lot of appeal to me, so I'd like to direct my brief remarks to just some suggestions on how to have productive conversations with other Latter-day Saints on topics of, in broad terms, environmental awareness. Like, having had some spectacularly unproductive conversations, it has given me occasion to think, okay, how can I approach this better? And how can I think there is something that is deeply Mormon about the environmental ethic in general terms. We have a hymn in our hymnal that says, "This earth was once a garden place." The foundation of our religion began in a woods that we call sacred, in a sacred grove, not just any grove, but a sacred. We could multiply these kind of examples for a long time. As Brad alluded to in his closing remarks, our 10th article of faith, we believe that this earth will be renewed and become a paradise. With that background, I think there are some distinctly Mormon ways to approach these topics. I'd like to confine my remarks just briefly to two things that we're very aware of here on the Wasatch Front. Starting with our issue with water. It's my understanding that with the construction of the Jordan L Dam now, there on Highway 40 south of Park City, that is it in terms of... There are no more places to put large water storage reservoirs on the Wasatch Front in northern Utah. What does this mean? Well, what the implications are that when it comes to water now, this is as big as the pie is going to get. So any further development we do will just be cutting the pie into smaller and smaller pieces. And that has implications for the way that we live and the way that we do development, which is fine. And this is where my first suggestion comes in, is that we can, when the young women stand up before their class and they recite whatever it is they call it, one of the lines is choice and accountability. Okay, this is pretty straightforwardly Mormon. We can make choices and we can be accountable for those choices. So when it comes to the way that we use water, okay, here's what water we have. And fasting and praying every year for more moisture is not a long-term solution. What is interesting to me is, I mean, maybe some of you are from Arizona or Nevada, or you go down there to visit your cousins or whatever. Latter-day Saints in Arizona landscape with dirt. I mean, you have dirt yards. And if you really want to keep up with the Joneses, then you plant a saguaro cactus out by the driveway. And so when I talk to Latter-day Saints in Arizona, and they hear that, okay, up in Utah they want us to fast and pray that they can have rain, to them it's a funny joke. Well, it's a joke. I'm not sure it's a funny one. But you mean we're here landscaping with dirt, and we're supposed to pray that those people up there can keep water in their half acre of grass? I actually saw it was pretty funny. There was a notice in the newspaper. A man had written to the newspaper saying, "I am upset with the water restrictions. I can't see why I can't just water my lawn when I want. My Kentucky bluegrass, it winter kills every year, and so I have to reseed. And now I can only, if I can only eat water every other day, then the seeds aren't going to germinate." And, okay, well, let's back up here. You live in an environment where your lawn dies every year, and long term, there's not enough water to keep. Okay, well, these are things we're going to have to rethink. These are choices we're going to have to make. The way that we do development, we're not going to be able to continue this, what we've done. Okay, so number one, choice and accountability. We have to make choices and be responsible for those choices. Those of you who have raised teenagers, or maybe you're young enough that you remember when you were a teenager, do you ever remember a conversation along the lines of, well, you can choose what you're going to do, but you can't choose the consequence of that action? I remember my son, when you pick up a stick, you pick up both ends of the stick. Sometimes with our natural environment, there's what we would call a kind of a tragedy of the commons, where nobody realizes, okay, what I'm doing contributes to this problem. It might just be a small part, but when there are a million people doing a small part, then it becomes a big problem. As was mentioned at the introduction, I remember when we didn't have an inversion on the Wasatch Front. When I was a little boy, the sky was blue in the winter. I remember that. And I remember coming back to visit after we'd moved away, and I came back and, okay, driving all the way across Nebraska and Wyoming, okay, it's winter time, but there's this beautiful blue sky and the snow, and even down through, you know, Colville and Hoytsville and Park City, and then you come over Parley Summit and you start to descend. What is this? Is it just a foggy day? No, it's not. This is what it is for months at a time. This is what we have chosen to do. This is the world we have created by our choices. And I don't think anybody intended it, but it's nonetheless, this is where we are, and it's not going to get better until we do something else. And in fact, we can guarantee that it will get worse. So this is, let me check my notes here. Yeah, this is the there's a certain type of Mormon who, well, President Ezra Taft Benson used a formulation once where he said God wants people to be humble, and we can either humble ourselves or we can be humbled involuntarily. And there's a certain type of Mormon who responds very directly and readily to being spoken to that way. And I think we can use that to our advantage here. With some of these situations, nature will win out in the end. I mean, the problem will get better eventually. The only question is how much pain is involved in the meantime. We don't get to choose the final outcome. All we get to choose is how do we want to do it the hard way or the easy way? And so when we can put it in those terms, and as Brad said, when we can start to understand that what we do has consequences. The choices that we make, we might not feel the effect now, but 20 years from now, people will feel it. I'd like to conclude again by referencing back to the 10th Article of Faith. One of the consequences of sin, what Mormons call the fall, we lost our connection to God and to each other. And we also lost paradise. We lost the garden. And I'd like to suggest that part of this process of redemption, we understand very, very well that being connected to God, reestablishing those connections to God and to each other, where, you know, Mormons use this particular word, the sealing. To us, that means salvation, that means redemption, where we're sealed to our friends and our family. And I'd also like to suggest that part of that process also is this reestablishing this connection to our to this physical environment, our paradise, which we lost as a consequence of our sin. Anyhow, thank you.
You're going to have to look at me. I'm sorry. I don't have a, as my professor says, I won't insult you with a slideshow. Sorry. I'm Melanie, or M. Franti, if you've been around the blog for a while, and start a little blog called Our Mother's Keeper. And there's not a whole lot I can say to you that you don't already know about environmental issues, because I suspect you're here for that reason, that you already care. Or you wanted to hear Mark Brown. I'm a friend, I'm a citizen, and I'm a student. I'm also really lazy, so that kind of conflicts with the first three items there. But I'm really passionate about a lot of things, one of them being the environment, land use in particular. I study geography and remote sensing. If you don't know what remote sensing is, I look at pictures from space, and I look to see what kind of changes are happening there? What's going on? And a lot of the things that I see are a lot of little pink roofs going up where once was farmland. It's kind of a sad thing. So what I've done is put a lot of my focus in and my passion into urban agriculture. And if you don't know what urban agriculture is, it looks a little bit like that. That's looks like a community garden, a very nice one actually, in the middle of the city somewhere. But it doesn't have to always look like that. It can literally be the front yard, backyard, doesn't matter, right?
Grow food. I thought that looked like your garden.
No. I haven't taken pictures of my garden yet. one of the things about urban agriculture and community gardens, or just growing food in general, is it helps to build community. Mormons love to talk about community, and I think they always think of it in terms of their ward, but they don't ever think in terms of their actual neighborhoods. And if you're a blogger, you think of it as your blog community. But something that's vital to community is a public space. And it's really unfortunate that this is... Where's the public space in this picture? There is it.
Road.
Yeah. I mean, really. I'm sorry that this is the best I could do for you guys, but because I'm lazy about slideshows. But yeah, there's no public space there. The way this works is, and this is how a lot of us live, right? We get in a car, in a little box, and we drive to a little box, and we live here, we work here, we shop here, we go to school here, and we go to church there. And we do it all, you know, by a little box. We never see our neighbors, we never talk to our neighbors, we don't know what's going on. The only thing we care about is our resale value. And maybe if the school's good, at least that's the excuse I hear. So how can we build community? You know, and the other thing I hear is there's a deterioration of community, and that's something that actually really ticks me off, because what are these people doing to help build it? So how can we build community when this is what we're constantly dealing with? I'm never good about going by my notes. So, 60 years ago, Americans were sold a product that promised convenience, space, upward mobility, family life. The American dream, right? And they bought it, hook, line, and sinker. How's it working out? James Kunstler said, America took its post-war wealth and invested it in a living arrangement that has no future. So, how can this, what we're looking at here, how can this provide, how can this do anything but provide a space to sleep and occasionally eat? It makes a car absolutely necessary. And in my opinion, it's a manufactured need. And then there's forced consumption on top of it. We need to have a car, we need to buy gas, we need to. And it's all a manufactured. Okay, so the point here is, how do we build community? Well, first thing is we act as citizens and we start working to build more public spaces. Public spaces are where we have to rub shoulders, we have to interact, right? We have to deal with each other, and it's so un-American, isn't it? We have to care about the common good, the commonwealth. So un-American. We've been programmed for so long to care about the private and the individual. And this really isn't about that. And this talk isn't so much about community as it is about local economies, which are really important. A lot of us believe that we're going to run out of oil. I absolutely do. And at some point, what are we going to do if we're completely unprepared for such a thing? How are we going to get our kids to school? We might have to walk them. So local economy is kind of where I wanted to go with this. And because I can't keep a thought in my head for longer than 2 minutes, I'll just borrow from Wendell Berry. So this is a long quote from him. So far as I can see, the idea of a local economy rests upon two principles, neighborhood and subsistence. In a viable neighborhood, neighbors ask themselves what they can do and provide for one another, and they find answers that they and their place can afford. This and nothing else is the practice of neighborhood. This practice must be, in part, charitable, but it must also be economic, and the economic part must be equitable. There is a significant charity in just prices. Of course, everything needed locally cannot be produced locally, but a viable neighborhood is a community, and a viable community is made up of neighbors who cherish and protect what they have in common. This is the principle of subsistence. A viable community, like a viable farm, protects its own production capacities. It does not import products that can produce for itself, that it can produce for itself, like breads, tomato, and cheese. And it does not export local products until local needs have been met. People actually used to do that in this country. They used to grow things, and they took care of their neighbors and themselves, and then if they had surplus, then they would take it to market. The economic products of a viable community are understood either as belonging to the community's subsistence or as surplus, and only the surplus is considered to be marketable abroad. So un-American, isn't it? A community, if it's to be viable, cannot think of producing solely for export, and it cannot permit importers to use cheaper labor and goods from other places to destroy the local capacity of produce goods that are needed locally. In charity, moreover, it must refuse to import goods that are produced at the cost of human or ecological degradation. Brad sent me a paper once. I don't remember who it was, but it was called The Oil We Eat.
Yeah, Richard Manning.
Do you want to say something about that real quick, just quickly?
Well, Manning's, he's basically talking about how the whole of the human activity writ large in our history is about energy. Mm-hmm. It's about the energy that we take into our bodies and the energy required to put that energy into our bodies. And the problem is that we have a limitless energy source that we can't directly access as people. Mm-hmm. The only thing we can get from the sun directly is vitamin D. But there are these great organisms out there that are wonderful at harnessing energy from the sun, and they're called plants. And they photosynthesize, and they convert the potential heat and radiative energy of the sun into food energy. But then there's this additional problem, which is that we can't eat a lot of the plants. And so we need animals to eat the plants for us. Either we need to process them in some way, or else we need animals to eat them, convert them into protein, so that we can access the sun's energy at that remove of sort of indirect consumption. But this is what this has led to is increasingly extractive ways of acquiring that energy. And so one of the practical consequences of this is that what we would consider to be the most sort of energy efficient sort of high quality foods, agricultural products, take way more from the soil than they put back. And so you couldn't have a cornfield that was highly productive, that was sustainable year in and year out. You've got to re-nitrogenate the soil. You've got to replenish again. You deplete, so you have to replenish. Well, how do you replenish soil? And the way that we do it is that we have discovered that in addition to these plants that store energy from the sun, there exists a form of like energy super trust funds in the world, right? Energy that came from the sun originally that has accumulated over hundreds of millions of years, and they're called hydrocarbons. We use them to power our cars, and we also use them to replenish the soil that we deplete with our massively extractive agriculture. So we can spend down, we can sustain current agricultural productivity by spending down in several generations the energy reserves that the Earth has built over literally hundreds of millions of years. But then what? And so, you know, when you think of is something being efficient or something being productive, right? We always think of that in monetary terms. We always think of it in terms of costs, of financial costs. So it's incredibly, we have these massive economies of scale for producing food, right? They begin on the farm. They begin, you know, in the oil fields first, where the hydrocarbons are harnessed and converted into fertilizer. The fertilizer is introduced into the soil to give it energy again that can be sucked out by its corn stalks. We produce the corn, then we process it, which requires more fossil fuel, and we cook it and we bake it and we package it, and then we send it on trucks all over the country and all over the world, and we use fossil fuel to do that.
Let me interrupt you here real quick. So the point I wanted to make with that is that that tomato, that piece of corn, mm-hmm. has a huge amount of fuel in that one particular item.
Right.
And let's be more mindful of that. If we can grow a tomato in our backyard and cut that, you know, we don't need to get it from Brazil or wherever they're growing it from, we're using a lot less energy, and we're consuming a lot less of the resources that we're supposed to be leaving for our children and grandchildren.
And there's this sort of inverse relationship between efficiency as measured by markets and efficiency as or productivity as measured by common sense. Because in the most basic sense, there's nothing that could be more efficient than subsistence farming. Right? You're literally if this definition of subsistence farming is that you're living off of it. And so the energy that you're expending to grow the food, you are replacing with the food that you grow. There's this harmonious relationship, like Adam and Eve eating from the sweat of their brow. So that's completely efficient. But it's expensive. It's not considered efficient in monetary terms. The most efficient thing you could do is buy food at Walmart, right? But the cost of that is that if you measure efficiency in terms of energy, right, calories, how many calories of energy does it take to produce, to put one calorie of Cheerios onto your table? And it takes over 80. So it's the more financially efficient it becomes, the more absurdly inefficient it becomes in terms of energy.
Okay, so going back to a local economy, and I'll wrap this up so we can do what we got to do. Like Barry says in that quote there, we all of our needs can't be met. We can't do it all at home, right? We know that. But we can work within a community. We can work within a region to have all those needs met and localize it and reduce our reliance on these hydrocarbons that he talks about. I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you for being here.
Great. So we're going to stop promptly at 10:45, which means we have about 13 minutes left for questions.
Not everybody at once.
I'm curious what each of you do. You mentioned you do your own gardening. How about you, Brad? And how are you guys doing approaching this on your own personal level?
So we're in an interesting situation where I'm in grad school, and my family and I we live out in Michigan in Ann Arbor, and part of what our particular circumstance places limitations on what we can do. For example, we live in student housing, so we can't grow a garden. But the upside to it is that we also don't have to drive very much. So it becomes easier to there's a strong sense of community where we live, which means it becomes easier to do things like have a communal table. So we eat together a lot with the people that we live, the people in our neighborhood, the people in our little area, and we try to find try to sort of force our kids into forms of recreation that don't require a power strip, and that's another nice thing about where we live is we have this kind of little forest right outside our door. So during half of the year, the kids are sort of regularly complaining about the fact that we're forcing them to play outside. But they also do enjoy it. And so, there are trade-offs. It would be nice if we had enough private space that we could grow a big garden. And we intend to someday. But part of the problem, as Melanie pointed out, is that a lot of those kinds of spaces where that is likely to be a possibility are in these quote-unquote neighborhoods where the cost of having a garden is that you have to drive everywhere. So part of the issue, I guess, is what I'm saying, part of the issue is trying to sort of, within the existing framework, trying to minimize your impact, trying to be conscious and responsible and make responsible choices, choice and accountability. But part of it also is reduced to this larger question. We have to fundamentally rethink and rearrange the whole edifice. And that's a different question.
I want to answer. I mean, I do all the little things. I don't even drive my car during the semester. I only drive it in the summer because I'm coming to university or things like this. I don't consume a lot. And these are just little things that really aren't in the big picture, aren't going to have an impact. But they sure do make me feel good. But I'm very active in my community. I believe in citizenship and being a part. And even though it's a very small voice, I'm there asking for things.
And you're starting blogs, and people are
also I'm educating people about how to grow their own food. You know, one of the things that one of my activisms is taking a red pepper the size like this is bright red and giving it to someone who lives in a neighborhood like that, and they go, "That was the best pepper I ever had." And I say, "I can show you how to do that." And through that, they learn little things here and there.
That garden was not in Salt Lake, was it?
No.
I haven't seen something like that around here.
But there's a lot of good gardens, not like that, but you know, a lot of great community gardens in this town. So, yeah, speak up, be a citizen, get off your butt.
I was just curious. My husband and I have been talking about like front yards and how all the houses are starting to get really small front yards and no porches, and because like people don't really talk to each other, they like just go in the backyard.
Yeah.
But we live in a house where we have a really big front yard and we have 3 kids under 3, so it's not like the safest place for them to play. And our lawn's pretty much yellow now.
Wait. You said it's not a safe place for them to play?
Yeah.
Why not?
There's a lot of cars that go in and out, and our 2-year-old runs into the street, and it's just hard to, like... So, you know, we have them play in the backyard, and there's this guy who speeds. That's a long story. Even though everyone in that neighborhood said, knock on the door.
We all know the guy who speeds.
Yeah, anyway. So it's just not until they're a little bit older and riding, you know. Anyway. Under 3, so. But our lawn's, like, turning yellow, so we're obviously the talk of the neighborhood. And I'd say it's because we're trying to save water, but usually, really, it's because we're kind of just lazy. But I'm trying to figure out what to do with, like, I feel like it's such a waste, like, our front yard. Like,
grow food.
I would like to do that, but... we have stuff in the backyard, like we're growing food in the backyard, but I thought it would be fun to do it in the front yard. But I'm sort of like kind of nervous about how like my neighbors will take it.
They'll
like,
get over it, I promise. Like, they learn really quickly that you're the weird one, and they just get over it. I mean, I grow poppies in my park strip, and they look like weeds right now, and eventually they'll die back, and I'll put something else in.
Because tomatoes, I don't even care if, like, the neighbors, like, come and take them, because, you know, how tomatoes and zucchinis just, like, grow like mad anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have no reason to, like, water it and keep it, like, grass.
I understand. So you have a couple of options. If you live in Utah, you can grow, Russian sage and other items. Lavender, things that don't require a lot of water.
That was what I was going to suggest.
Yeah, you know, rust and shade, just throw that in the ground, it'll take
care. Natural landscaping.
Yeah, natural landscaping. And it's beautiful.
It is.
It's stunning.
It can be done very well.
Yeah,
so like sage.
Yeah, and you want to have as much green as you want because, you know, I'm not a big fan of xeriscaping because it just, you know, all it does is a big heat sink. You want as much, and it doesn't, you know, retain water. So... Yeah.
So no, just limit xeriscape.
I'm not a fan of that.
Uh-huh.
I think you needn't worry about your neighbors. We live in the lower avenues of Salt Lake. And I don't know if you're familiar with those areas. But homes, for the most part, especially where we live on the lower avenues, are very close. We have a very tiny backyard. And then we have the sidewalk out in front. And then there's probably about maybe 12 feet from there to the gutter. And it used to be that the city, by regulation, wanted you to keep up a lawn there. In the last few years, this whole area has been kind of modifying that, and the city's even changed its rules a bit. I think the current one is that you can grow about anything there that's supposed to be up to 8 inches. However, they do not enforce that. And our mayor is very ecologically plus. And so 3 years ago, we took out half of our front lawn. And, oh, there's terrible rocks there. And this was a job, but we got all the rocks out. I shouldn't say all. Many of them. And this, we had it done so that when trash pickup came, they could take them all, which is once a year. This year, we have 15 tomato plants out in front. We have, closer up to our house, bok choy and kale. And we have some chard, not very much. It didn't work out too well this year, but last year it did. Parsnips, carrots. And the neighbors come by. There's apartment houses down the way. And they're just very friendly, and they talk about it, you know. And yeah, we're kind of one of the weird ones. But we're not the only ones, even in the avenues. There are others that have things growing that are edible.
And you can work in flowers. I have a flower garden mixed in with everything.
Yes.
And there's supposed to be a picture of a front yard that's completely edible, mixed in with flowers too. Landscape, but I forgot to put it up there so that you can see that.
Well, on the issue of neighbors, you know, you can think of it as something, because it's strange and because there are these sort of like regulations and these sort of implicit rules about how the yards are supposed to look. You can think of it as something that has the potential to alienate you from your neighbors, but it's more helpful to think of it as something that has the potential to be a tiny little springboard for increased community, because one of the things that's great about having food, as Melanie will tell you, is sharing it. And there is something sort of ineffably seductive about a garden that is productive. And as the neighbors walk by, even if at a distance, they're kind of turned off by the fact that there's this garden growing in somebody's front yard. If they walk by and they see you and they see food growing, they're going to be taken by it.
Yeah.
And it has a powerful community effect.
Yeah, better than
effect.
The yellow grass, right?
The yellow grass is going nowhere. It isn't doing anything for you. But
I think something that you could do is tell your neighbors, you want to plant a butterfly and bird garden for the neighborhood kids. Do they have any input on what kind of plants would look beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
Plant a little narrow path, put a fruit tree in, put in, you know, things that have seed heads for the winter for the birds to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Say, you know, this is for the kids, and I want them to see food growing. I want them to learn to harvest. You know, do you want to participate in this?
We put a plum tree in the backyard, and the reason we chose a plum tree was that after talking to the Extension Service, there was less chance that we'd ever need to spray. It's almost, you know, no upkeep except for the pruning.
You really might be setting an example. I think there are a lot of people who, among whom you live, who would probably appreciate you taking that first step.
Do any of you, see much traction in terms of Mormon history, in terms of, you know, this great kind of legacy we have in terms of home production, self-reliance, not in terms of provident living,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of an actual spiritual component, kind of having a revival among?
So probably our last question.
I don't know about official channels, but I think that, you know, I think the blog is part of the revival, hopefully. And I think that as issues of land and land use and resource management and climate change and peak oil, you know, as these kinds of things gain increasing attention and the stakes, what's at stake becomes more widely known, that it is possible for all people, but Mormons in particular, to sort of recognize what seems to be a categorical truth of our religion, which is that you cannot have ties to each other, lasting, meaningful ties to other people, without also lasting, meaningful ties to place that you care about and care for and are connected to.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that is one... That is one benefit I see of the way that we structure the youth programs, really like the Boy Scouts and the Young Women's mm-hmm. Camp. There's this remnant of going into the wilderness that we still have retained. And I don't see that going away anytime soon.
Great. Well, our next session is plenary. It'll be 11 o'clock in the Wildcat. Let's give one last round of applause for our speakers. Thank you.